Hello and welcome to the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann, a listener-supported program. My guest for this episode is Mark Lakeman, an architect and permaculture educator from Portland, Oregon. This is the second interview with Mr. Lakeman. You'll find a link to the first half in the show notes, and I recommend you start there. In this conversation, we talk about permaculture and our city landscapes. Part of this is practical in examples of how to rebuild our communities and bring people together, as well as understanding further the story we ourselves inhabit, as well as the story of our cultures, and how we can use permaculture to understand those stories and build regenerative cities. With the places Mark took the conversation, I did my best just to hang on and enjoy the ride. At the time, I wasn't left with too much to say, but do have further thoughts now, which I'll share with you after the interview. To find out more about Mr. Lakeman, you can visit his website at marklakeman.net, his architectural site, communitecture.net, or the Planet Repair Institute at planetrepair.org. Links for all of these are in the show notes page at thepermaculturepodcast.com. If you enjoy this show, or any others, please help me keep things moving and growing. Find out how at thepermaculturepodcast.com/support. Now then, on to Mark Lakeman. I'll join you afterwards with my thoughts and some updates. The last time we spoke, you touched on just kind of taking action without permission to build these joyous spaces and to get people to kind of buy into them without necessarily needing the nod from formal government until they're in place, and that's kind of breaking down the barriers of accomplishing some of these things in trying to build a better world. And I was wondering if you could take that from just not really seeking permission to walk us through some of the things that you are doing on the ground that are building regenerative urban systems.
All right. Well, the activity I'm presently engaged with and the various groups of people I'm doing things with span a pretty broad spectrum from just very grassroots initiatives that are self-help in nature to larger professional design projects. All these projects are characterized by a deeper, more hands-on level of creative engagement than you would ordinarily see. Like, for instance, in a design project, you might have a client who's creating a product to sell. That's the kind of framework that they're approaching it in. And we don't create products. We really like to be working with people who are initiating something that they wish to inhabit, whether it's an individual or an entrepreneur even, or a community. We really don't want to be working in a speculative vein, but more in a way where people are intentionally engaging design processes in order to make something that's lasting in the world. So along those lines, I think maybe our most famous design project that is regenerative is the Rebuilding Center in Portland, which is one of the leading facilities in the country that redirects materials out of the waste stream and reconditions them and makes them available for the public to use again. And talking about 2x4s and doors and windows and toilets and light fixtures and that sort of thing, that would otherwise just go to a landfill, but instead all these materials continue to have new cycles of life by being repurposed and used in fresh ways. So it's a demonstration project itself for how to repurpose and reuse materials. But that's nice. But the permaculture really gets started in the fact that the people who live there, who work there, all come from within walking distance in terms of where they live, their relationship to living and working. So really trying to eliminate the need for transportation of any kind and to get people on their feet walking through their own neighborhood and really, speaking of mixed use, really trying to treat the neighborhood as a village and the Rebuilding Center as an economic kind of catalyst or rejuvenative and an engine for the uplifting of the whole community, but by the community for itself. So everyone who works there comes from within walking distance, but everyone also gets living wages, while at the same time, the materials that are for sale, some of them are outstanding materials based on old growth lumber, for instance, but that cost pennies on the dollar compared to what you would purchase at some corporate outlet like Home Depot. Everyone's family is covered for full health and dental benefits, not just themselves, but their families as well. So it's a really stellar example of taking stuff that most people would consider waste and alchemizing it again into a resource and then using that resource as the basis for restoring the community, rather than just tearing down the fabric of the community to take the materials that might be otherwise turned into waste, and instead deconstructing things in order to reuse them. And then that has this massive social benefit, not just in the fact that people are getting paid well or that they're getting benefits, but they actually all help to run the organization. Everyone has a voice and power in that community. So the embrace between the community and that commercial entity is deep. The dedication of the bioregion to this facility is extremely impressive. So that's one example. I can give you many more at smaller scales as well.
I popped over to the website for the Rebuilding Center, and I'm looking at this, that you're doing education, you're finding furniture that can be reused, and also that you're offering deconstruction services. Or I should say that the Rebuilding Center is also offering deconstruction services to go out and actually, I guess, demo sites in order to pull the material and make them reusable?
Yes. It's a fascinating approach that they have, where people are able to actually make deconstruction economically or monetarily competitive with demolition, because people are able to get a write-off for the building as if it's a donation. So the building is deconstructed and the Rebuilding Center takes the materials, but then the value of the materials can be written off as a donation. So in effect, you're donating your house. In Portland, we're actually working on making it illegal to tear things down anymore without having to go through several layers of reconsideration before such an act would be taken. Naturally, we're facing opposition from demolition companies, but it's long past time that we salvage and repurpose all of this perfectly reusable material rather than mowing down forests, right, when we need to be sequestering carbon. So these projects and policy initiatives that are related are very timely and holistic.
Trying to integrate the ideas of regeneration and, well, making no waste and reusing the embodied energy in what's already there through not only the physical choices that we make, but also getting that enacted within the political structure as well, or I guess the legal structure.
Yeah, and we've got to engage all these levels. You're asking about regenerative initiatives, and this is certainly one. I don't think anything is going to end up being regenerative unless it really addresses things in terms of whole systems. Because after all, a lot of this destruction is driven by ill-considered policy. We might be able to win a metaphorical battle here or there, but we'll certainly lose the overall struggle unless we address the political and economic systemic drivers that are contributing so much to the problem.
Some of the conversations I've been having along those lines point to the need for almost a multi-generational, or if you will, 100-year plan for shifting away from a wholly consumeristic society to where we're actually thinking about the way that our choices have an impact, rather than just saying, oh, well, this is broken, I'll get another one. But even before we purchase something or bring it into our lives, to make a better decision about what that should be and to invest in ourselves and what we do moving forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, every day people are interacting with things like paper or plastic bags, you know, that sort of question. These days, it's getting harder and harder, even in Portland, Oregon, to recycle a plastic bag. And besides, you know, why should we be doing that anyway? But the fact that it's getting more difficult to recycle a plastic bag is forcing people to finally come to grips with they're relying on the convenience of these things. In my household, which is a cooperative, we've simply decided to sew reusable bags out of various kinds of cloth. Some of it's waterproof, and to make our own very strong and resilient reusable bags and just completely eschew plastic. No, that's not even very high tech, so I think it's a pretty good example of what you're talking about. You're asking, I think, before, sort of tending toward a more grassroots, accessible level of how we engender regenerative culture through placemaking. I want to give him an overarching response. I think, first of all, the work that we're doing in Portland is to help people realize that they live in a colonial infrastructure and that there's a big difference between the landscapes that people like to go visit, that they save their money and travel across the oceans to go visit, and our landscape. The places that we love most are the ones that tend to be wrought over time by hands, not perfect places. Nowhere is perfect, but, and I'm saying that because I'm not meaning to idealize indigenous villages, but nonetheless, when something is an expression of a place-based community, it is most likely tuned pretty well to their values and their needs. It's designed by them in an over, in a sort of a social self-designing process, socially based self-designing process over time, in which they get to iterate and reiterate their ideas. There may be a hierarchy and there may be some controls or even some kind of local code or tradition that is guiding or regulating them, but it's very, very fundamentally different than how we live in this country, on this continent, where most of what we inhabit is created as a product to be consumed, to be purchased, to be paid for over time through labor, but in which the story is initiated by people who are not invested in inhabiting the place or the story. So, of course, as we're already very familiar with, the bottom line in many cases controls what we end up inhabiting, and a lot gets cut out of those budgets, places to sit, places to interact, forms of social commons. Because we're living in a colonial infrastructure, and this is a point that we really want to raise in cities, you know, everywhere where we're at work, because we're living in a colonial infrastructure, commons simply aren't provided for a lot of different reasons, but it's resulted in the fact that we have the lowest number of outdoor gathering places of all First World nations here in the USA, and the highest incidence of violence related to the absence of gathering places in our communities. We're literally living in places where people talk to each other less often because the way that our communities have been laid out actually omitted the places where we would otherwise gather and communicate, learn each other's names, share stories, you know, learn something about each other's story, our skills and talents, and maybe grow a more resilient local economy, maybe the basis of an alternative reality, you know, maybe even an actual genuine democratic condition of place-based community, engendering its own economy, making its own sort of cycles of decision-making and project creation. So we're trying to raise an awareness around this fundamental issue that we live in a landscape that we in many ways have built, but we did not imagine. And in some ways, we've built it, but we haven't created it. So it doesn't meet our needs. And it's, I think you could say it's making us crazy. So the projects that we're doing, especially in Portland, have to do with getting people to come out of their houses to help them realize that they have a lot in common with other people. For one thing, their isolation is something that they share. That comes as a revelation. In Portland, we've managed to legalize the transformation of all public right-of-ways into cultural space. So almost anywhere in the city can become a public gathering place. Streets can be transformed into gathering places. And the spaces between sidewalks and streets can now all be repurposed agriculturally, or interactive cultural features can be, you know, sort of ecological sustainability prototypes can be installed all across the city. Whether it's a place to sit, or it's a place for creative expression, it can be a seed-sharing station, it can be a self-service library. I've seen interactive poetry stations. Basically, the limit is whatever the community wants to imagine and create together as a way of reconnecting, engaging youth, and accomplishing all these local benchmarks that have to do with sustainability and livability. So the projects that we're doing are not even really our ideas anymore. It's whatever people want to do. And we as an organization, City Repair or Communitecture, we assist people in sort of help, walking them through the process of undertaking their own ideas and then finding resources and support and then creating these things. We sort of hold their hand while we hold the city's hand, the city government's hand, help everybody get along and get through a process that helps really transform not just the neighborhood, but the city government as well. So the spectrum of these projects is fantastic. And in Portland, there's something over 500 of them now across the city.
So you find yourself in a role where you're opening doors for other people, and as you provide these open spaces that people can work within, both physically and metaphorically, that people are taking that opportunity to step into those spaces and bring about change on their own?
Yeah, I think for those of us who aspire to change the world, it's an important realization, I think, to come upon that we're not going to get it done by ourselves. So figuring out a way to be a facilitator for other people, I think, is an important, very, very important strategy to kind of give up the need to see things manifest in a form that, say you have a really powerful and experienced activist who kind of knows how to do things, whether it's rainwater catchment or building with natural materials some beautiful gathering place. They understand the issues. Well, they're not going to be able to get enough done, and they're not going to be able to get enough done fast enough. And besides, we're talking about a sustainable society, so it's the society itself that has to be transformed. So the people who have the experience and the knowledge at this point can continue to work. You know, it's utterly satisfying to use your own hands, but at the same time, I think it's a much more effective strategy to be a creative facilitator of other people's emergence. Like, you know, decide, okay, if you're going to put in a rain barrel, how can you engage local kids so that they learn how to do it, and how can you do it in a way that inspires them to want to help other people? So you're really trying to engender a kind of an antiviral effect in your community.
There's a thought that someone shared with me once, is that we have to empower people to trust themselves and to trust their own ability, that in some ways our society now is, well, you mentioned that idea of isolation, and that's something that we share. And as I've mentioned before on this show, I was raised that the idea would be that I'd go work a job to raise money that then I would pay someone else to make the repairs around my home, and I would never learn certain skills. And as a result of that, now that I'm trying to learn those skills, I don't have any level of confidence to do that.
Yeah.
That I don't trust myself to swing a hammer in a way that's meaningful. But that for my own life, if I could find someone to teach me some of those skills to give me the confidence to do it, that then I might feel that I can take that on and in turn share that with others. And that sounds like that's a big part of this process, is finding those things that, if you will, we're good at and capable of, and to share that with others so that we can show them that they're capable as well.
Yeah, absolutely. That's a very, very important part of a cultural revolution. And how can you enact a revolution when people don't feel capable? And it's not just capable of swinging a hammer or driving a screw or cutting a board. You literally become less capable. If you don't have hand skills, you can't think as effectively, spatially or conceptually. It's harder to analyze a context and design solutions in a lot of different realms if you don't have practice actually alchemizing raw materials into something that you've envisioned. It's like flexing our brain muscles in a way. It actually is true across disciplines. I mean, people imagine that architects must be very effective at envisioning a better world, but frankly, it's kind of a joke about architects that most of them don't know how to build the things that they're sitting there trying to imagine. They actually don't have the practical knowledge that would should be informing their choices. Since they've not built, they don't know how to organize a job site. They don't know how to design a detail that actually effectively sheds water off of a roof. They don't know how to design things so that you know how to put one thing together with another thing in order to effectively make something that's easy to put together. Sometimes designs can be awful and cumbersome and unnecessarily expensive, and that's just reflecting their limited range of experience. But the reason I'm going on about this is because the fact that you feel like you don't have those skills isn't really even your choice or your fault. It's actually part of the design of cities. It's the way that expansionist-based, sort of empire-oriented urban structures are formulated. And it's the way that these things are designed and how they are envisioned to proceed in their growth as a facilitator of expansionism is actually written in books. You can go to the library, almost any public library, check out Greco-Roman military planning by Xenophon and see the entire agenda is laid out. People must be specialists and not generalists. They have to work in specific disciplines and not cross over disciplines. People In order to make the city an effective mechanism for expanding into frontiers and driving the process of expansionism, everyone has to be, I mean, this is literally envisioned and written on paper and then enacted in cycles over and over again through time, that people have to be specialists to feed this larger machine. I mean, from the very earliest ages in our society, children are slotted into a career track before they're even done playing. They haven't even set down their toys yet, and they're being asked by adults, you know, what are you going to do when you grow up? Because adults don't have anything better to talk about, because that's maybe what they've been conditioned to think about. You know, this is who I am. I make shoes. You know, I make shoelaces for a living. I make big gulp cups for a living. I check out people at a counter all day long for a living. Everyone's a specialist within the design of the city-state. Yeah, you can find this stuff. It's not necessarily what a village becomes, though. Like a human-scale village can actually grow into a larger sort of sprawling urban structure, and at a certain point, people do tend to specialize as the scale increases. But the city-state model, you know, that is really the administrative center envisioned in Westward Expansion and Manifest Destiny and codified in the National Land Ordinance of the USA, is designed to be implanted violently over conquered people and then expand aggressively as mining and deforestation proceed as the basis of economic development. Like, you know, environmental destruction is actually designed into the way that the city-state is implanted and grows. In Roman colonialism, this is called the castrum. The castrum was the military encampment. It's literally laid out to become the city-state that it grows into. Like, the pathways between the tents become exactly the roadways of the military grid as it proceeds to become a colony that's built with permanent materials. And then the infrastructure of, you know, sewageways and aqueducts proceeds to be enacted. So it's a formula. It's not a conspiracy. It's a formula that is so broad and pervasive. We literally live in it. It's under our noses everywhere around us. It's so normative at this point that we just take it for granted as if this is just reality. But actually, it's aggressively designed. It's been built for thousands and thousands of years over conquered people. So within that framework, people are waking up to realize that they actually do live in an oppressive, coercive infrastructure. And simply by coming out of people's houses and deciding to put in a bench where people can actually sit and socialize, they're challenging this entire sort of stream of suppositions and objectives that no living person even really understands anymore. It's so ancient and it's so you know, been sort of generated so long ago. Small things that people are undertaking, you know, to create a demonstration project of some kind that is created by people coming out and doing stuff together, engages gigantic issues. And it calls into question, you know, whose paradigm is this? Whose story are we inhabiting? Can we create our own story? Can we be actors and participants in our own story? Does the story always have to lead to self-destruction and the implosion of the empire? Or perhaps can it transition to something else? Can there be reparations? Can we all wake up to realize we're all conquered villagers after all? So the dialogues that we see proceeding as people engage with each other are of course, rich and beautiful and various, very diverse, always, always unique as people are kind of trying out ideas with each other.
You've led me to a place where I have no follow-up. I just have questions that I need to now go explore and look at and answer that question of whose story am I inhabiting?
Yeah.
Or to put it away, one of my friends would say, I think you just broke my brain, sir. I mean that in a good way, that it's certain questions that I've had as this person within my own life and the questions that I've had and trying to move away from that idea of a career towards a calling to find something that was more meaningful than just a paycheck every day. And the place that you've led me when it comes to the story of society now just kind of leaves me open to needing to ask more questions within my own life.
I understand what you're saying. I think this is sort of reminding me of the kind of whole red or blue pill question in The Matrix. Do you really want to know or do you not want to know? It sort of depends. If you don't even choose a pill, then you kind of don't go any farther in the game and you don't really know anything more. I don't think I could ever choose to not know. I don't think I've ever gotten to the point where I feel so hopeless that I wouldn't choose to know more. But this kind of information, to understand that we're in a colonial framework, helps us to tap into our story in a way that I think some people can feel hopeless, but I personally feel empowered by it. Especially for me, a lot of this awareness came when I was traveling around the world for about 7 years and I was visiting different indigenous societies. I was looking to understand settlement patterns more intimately. I wanted to see how multi-generational place-based communities lived in relation to the society where I had grown up. And at a certain point in one particular community where I spent a whole lot of time, this is a group of Mayans that had retreated from the Spanish 500 years ago, and they had gone into isolation to try to preserve their culture, and they weren't recontacted until about 80 years ago, so they've never been sort of converted, they've never been Christianized, so there's a direct continuity back to their pre-colonial state. So it's very, very inspiring to be there. It was really like being on the planet Earth for the first time. It was I was witnessing permaculture in an extremely integrated state in the context of a jungle. So, it was verdant and it was upsetting, even on a biological level, to see how people could be when they belong where they are. Again, I don't want to idealize or romanticize, but it was profoundly different than living in a city where, children can become victims at any time, where people feel powerless, yet there's supposed to be a rule of the majority. In this case, their political infrastructure, how they made decisions, how they would confront issues, their regenerative planting cycles within thin rainforest soil, planting almost perpetually, harvesting almost perpetually from the soil because of their approach. Just astounding. And the fact that, they were rooted in that place with such deep knowledge of its cycles, of the hatching of insects corresponding to planting cycles and the way the whole thing was mythologized. Anyway, while I'm there, at a certain point, I remember apologizing for westward expansion and the invasion of their lands and the destruction of their cities and just like crying. I was saying, I'm sorry for what Europeans have done here. And this person just looks at me with the most compassionate smile and he says, he actually walks over and he held my face with his hands. He looked into my eyes and he said, "You cannot take this upon yourselves," meaning not just me, but all of us that are here and that have taken over this land. He said, "You guys cannot take this upon yourselves." And I said, "What are you talking about? I'm European. Look what we've done." He said, "No, you only did this because of what was done to your people so long ago you don't even know your own story." He said, "You, in fact, are a villager just as we are. And the only reason that you've done this to us is because it was done so long ago, you don't know who you are." He said, "At least we know who we are. We know enough of our story to know, who we are and where we belong and what has happened to us." He said, "Not you. You're walking through life searching for a way to connect and not knowing the basis of what has happened to you." So he actually explained colonialism. He said, "I know that where you live within long, straight, flat lines. What you need to do is go home and look at those lines and ask yourself, when did the story of your family come into contact with those lines? And when you know that when that intersection occurred, you'll know who you are." And of course, he was, without even knowing my specific history, he was telling me, "You were a Celt at one time. The Romans invaded your village. They destroyed it and they conscripted the survivors to help them build the empire, and they imposed the Roman grid over the villages of your ancestors." But I went back to Portland, Oregon, and I stood in a street intersection that I had grown up next to my whole life, living in isolation in a community that was zoned where living and working was separated, and nobody understood what was happening. Nobody understood that there was no village square and that that was just normal all across the continent because of policy, and that nobody had ever chosen that. And I stood there in this intersection, that I had played in as a kid, and I was like, "My God, I can see now that I'm living in a huge grid. You know, I'm living in a series of boxes, and none of us even realize it. So for me, that was a revelation. I could finally see that I was living in a gigantic framework that had been imposed over all of these cultures that probably died resisting the violence of it. And suddenly I had a story that enabled me to relate to that grid in a deeper, longer time frame. Like, wow, this has washed over the planet like a tsunami, and it has destroyed villages everywhere that it's been imposed. So it enabled me to stand there and say, this stops with me. You know, this stops right here. I'm not going to just blindly go ahead and pretend that I don't know anymore. I can see that there's no place to sit for a grandmother between where she lives and where she goes to get her food. We've eliminated places even of sitting in our midst. Like, the streets were a commons at some point in our history, a space between our homes that would bring us together, but now we live in this place where by ordinance, the only activity that's allowed to happen in the streets is the movement of goods and services and cars and pedestrians that go between A and B, but we're not supposed to linger and stop along the way and build culture. You know, where are the gathering places that are supposed to punctuate the landscape that our ancestors used to create, you know, in villages before, you know, they were destroyed? So I was able to see that, you know, I'm living in a story, but it's not mine, and I don't like this story. So the work that I've been doing, the stuff that I'm able to contribute to this placemaking work that we're doing in Portland, you know, personally, I'm able to contribute a perspective like this to point out to people that we're supposed to have freedom of assembly, but there's nowhere to assemble. The places where we live are characterized by paradox that are hurting our very families and breaking down our relationships. I've had, you know, just even recently with my father, who is this really well-known planner in the city of Portland, I was able to help him understand that through the design of the city, we actually break families apart, like because of zoning. At the beginning of every day, fathers leave families to go work elsewhere, rather than being present as mentors to their children as they used to be. Now children, of course, go off to a public education that we worked so hard to create, and at the same time, we break apart the family and we make generation gaps sort of a dysfunctional outcome simply because of how we zone the growth of our children and their education away from the family, the place-based community. And then the aberrant behaviors that arise from children because they're not present with their actual familial mentors, you know, their true mentors, creates so much dysfunction that we see playing out in our society in terms of alienation and disenfranchisement every day. So, I mean, what we have is design dysfunction. We have stacked dysfunctions from a permacultural perspective that have resulted from the design of the very city, the colonial city that we live in. So this, to me, is the ultimate framework for the challenge of permaculture. And I do think that permaculture, the patterns of, and principles of permaculture that we can bring to bear are actually functional. It's a design program that acts like an antivirus. It actually inverts the design patterns of colonialism. The colonialism designs the separation and the isolation and the specialization of people. Permaculture intends to engender networks and relationships and connections. It aspires to teach people that there's mutual benefit that can be had through the choices that we make. Instead of needing to win over each other and beat each other, instead, much more can come for everyone if everyone is benefiting instead of just a few. So permaculture, I think, presents us a set of strategies that can address this condition, but we have to understand that the social culture itself is an ecology, and that the principles of permaculture actually apply to ourselves as well. I think if we start designing that way, then we have a chance, we really have a chance to change the world, and I think rapidly.
I don't know where I originally intended for our conversation to go today, but I don't think that matters because I like the places that you've taken it, and I appreciate your perspective. It's not one that I've encountered thus far. Some of the ideas resting with how we can use permaculture, if you will, internally, to bring about change within ourselves and then our community around us. There are certain hallmarks within some other conversations I've had, but the story that you told to bring that all together is very different from what I've encountered before, and I'm thankful for that. I really don't have anything at this moment that I would add to this conversation. Is there anything that you would like to add for the listeners before we bring everything to a close?
I'd just like to say thanks for making space for us to talk, because I personally find a lot of benefit when I get to have a conversation that's really well facilitated like this. It helps me to realize things that I hadn't seen before. So I'm really glad for that. Some feelings have been stirred up in me today that I'll be sitting with for the rest of the day. That'll probably affect some of my next choices, but have given me some insights. So I'm going to sort of sit with those. Yeah, I just really appreciate our conversation, and I look forward to talking again in the future.
And that was Mark Lakeman. Sometimes I'd like to go through an interview and reflect on it point by point in these end notes and give a full breakdown of all my thoughts that come from a given conversation. But if I did that, I think I'd only release 8 shows a year, and they'd each be 8 hours long. I'd become more like Dan Carlin's Hardcore History, rather than this weekly show featuring so many good guests. Because of that, I'm left with wanting to only take so much time during these end-of-show wrap-ups, so that they don't get too long-winded. So in this case, and paired with the last interview with Mark, are 3 pieces that I scribbled down on wanting to regeneration by addressing whole systems, becoming a facilitator for other people, and using permaculture to inhabit your own story. When it comes to regenerating the world around us by addressing whole systems, I think back to the interview with Michael Pilarski. As you might be able to tell, it had quite an impact on me. I almost think of his idea about cleaning up our own little piece of the world as a principle on how to approach getting all the work done that rests before us. That rather than trying to do a whole lot, that by doing a little we can make a big difference. In this broader context of what Mark brought up, includes moving beyond the landscape and the wild to be involved in our local community, build relationships with neighbors, and engage others. I've found that one of the easiest ways to start breaking down those interpersonal walls is by remembering that kindness costs me nothing, and it can bring joy and delight in the world for others. I've been surprised what a difference this makes for my relationships with others, and what can happen by taking the time to make a space for someone where they can be open, honest, and vulnerable. As Dave Jackie said, you know, to borrow from 1984, vulnerability is strength. I understand that not everyone is comfortable with something like this. I am, after all, a bit extroverted by the nature of what it is that I do. So what I'm really asking is that you find your own ways to open doors and space for others. How can you show kindness in your own way every day? From my interview with David Holmgren, he implored that each of us have our own broad niches that we fill, that we're not singularly focused, but have multiple disciplines that we call our own, as well as developing and maintaining generalist skills that we can use in our day-to-day lives, which I think also speaks to what Mark said about stepping away from over-specialization. And I think that that's a place where we can reach out and aid by becoming facilitators for other people. Each of us have skills and abilities we can share with others. In my own life, it's why I enjoy teaching so much. As I've said to several friends, I don't want to wind up being the giant whose shoulders other people eventually stand on. Rather, I want to stand there beside the people who might be considered my students and help them find the tools and skills they need so that together we can build the steps that they will use to stand on the shoulders of the giants in their own field. It's why I continue to put on this show, so you can hear other voices to connect to, and also why I want to go study informal education at the doctoral level. Yeah, I think it will be fun to be called Dr. Man in certain settings, but I really want to ensure that each and every one of you can find a path that works and gets you to where you want to go. To do that has required me to find my own story, my own life, and be a part of it. For you to find your own path, you need to understand your own story and inhabit it. I know we don't all have the same opportunities in our lives for different reasons, and that some of us have been damaged by this life, be it physically, mentally, or emotionally. But we can work on ourselves to grow and be the people we want to. Take the time to use the principles of permaculture and look at yourself. Observe your life and interact with it. But also, if you need help, get it. If you can help others, provide it. Though it may be many years spent doing something we don't enjoy, so we have the time and other resources to pursue our real interests, we can get there. My own path took over a decade, and the wandering and trying to figure things out was a bit self-destructive at times, but I was able to move past that and turn it into something positive. Let's work together to make sure your journey doesn't take as long as mine did, or if it does, that you're able to enjoy every moment of it along the way. Wherever you are on your own path, I'd love to hear from you. You can reach me by email, show@thepermaculturepodcast.com, or by phone, 717-827-6266. You can also follow the show on Facebook and join in the conversation at facebook.com/thepermaculturepodcast, or on Twitter, where I am @permaculturecst. The next interview, and the last one of the year, will be out on December 17th. My guest is Adam Campbell of the Peace and Permaculture Center, located adjacent to the Stillwater Sanctuary. Adam lives at the sanctuary along with Ethan Hughes and the others who call that community home. That show is part one of at least three or maybe even four or more. Adam and I talked for quite some time that day, and I'll be releasing those episodes over time, such that you'll get no more than one a month and have plenty of other interviews in between. I'm also working on two shorter shows. One is about how I get things done, which some folks asked for after the interview with Jack Spierko. That idea of getting things done also relates to professional permaculture, which led me to want to put together a show on integrity and permaculture, harkening back to the conversation I had with Dave Jackie, where he and I talked about being impeccable with your word. I'll be taking off from December 20th through the 30th to spend time with my family for the holidays, so the last show of the year will be out on Tuesday, December 31st. That last episode is going to be a look back over the past year, as well as a look forward into the next, and also serve as a primer for folks who are new to permaculture and this podcast. And the last update for this show. You should notice that the website response and download times are quicker, as the move to the new server is complete. There were a few errors that took a little bit to shake out, but things so far are going well. If you happen to notice anything that seems off, please let me know. That will wrap this episode of the Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann. Until the next time, take care of the earth, yourself, and each other. And that little bit of legal. The Permaculture Podcast with Scott Mann is released under Creative Commons, Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives License. Feel free to share it, as long as you let people know where you got it from, and don't change or sell it.